This is a conversation for the record. This is a travelogue documenting a community on a hero's journey through a dark wood, and it begins and ends with curiosity. This is a podcast, but really, it's just an excuse for me to dig in and connect with somebody. This is Find a Way. Our guest this week is my friend and neighbor Larson McBride. Larson is a professional natural scientist. His job title is literally Scientist 3, and jury's out on whether he ever wants to be Scientist 4, because he belongs out in the woods and the fields, not behind a desk. In my phone, Larson's nickname is Planta Claus because of his frequent bouts of gifting friends and neighbors various trees, herbs, and native flora, and he'll help you plant them too. So buckle up, folks, because after this conversation, you may never think about your relationship to nature the same way again. Thanks for finding your way here today. Enjoy.
Okay. You've got permission at any point.
Okay.
And that doesn't just go for today, like anytime you're over.
Sure. Yeah. Well, when we were walking back here, I was like, if I take one step further, I will be the farthest into Colin's house that I've ever been.
That's right. You've never been in my little office back here.
I haven't. I've heard you playing the piano back here before.
Okay. Yeah, that's right. When you guys walk.
Walk by your house every single day.
Yeah.
Yeah. The owls are back. Saw the owls day before yesterday, first time this year. That was really nice to see them back.
Yeah, they've been kind of, I think they're like dipping their talons in the water again over the last like month or so. And yeah, so like I would say every other day or so, we've got them hanging out in the front tree. They're way more skittish than previous year. I'm not sure if it's this. I don't think it's the same owls. But they don't like it when you look at them or like when you make eye contact.
Sure. Well, that's fine because, you know, after like I have a long, strange history of interacting with owls, and I've come to a place where I am not really all that comfortable or really motivated at all to like make eye contact with them, much less do all the other stuff that I used to do with them, you know, like call them down and stuff like that.
Were you able? So yeah, Leanne's told me about that. Like you used to like do your owl calls and they would come to you.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And I think that I got, you know, naturally very excited about it.
Right. Oh my God. That would be, I would think that I was a superhero.
It feels that way. And the more that I learned about other people's perspective on owls, the more I started to write a narrative in my head, you know, you write stories, and started thinking, is all this really bizarre sort of unfortunate stuff that I keep on running into tied in any way with kind of riling up these owls?
Yeah. Okay.
And getting them too close to me.
What kind of stuff were you learning about them?
Well, a lot of people view owls as like guardians of the underworld or the next realm, or, you know, kind of like protectors of this realm from, you know, entities with like, I guess like, maybe like less savory, motivations for, you know, the actions that they want to, you know, perpetrate in our world, any kind of like level like that.
Do you, when you say that they're like, guardians, are you saying they're guarding us from these things, or are you saying that they're like in service of these negative?
I think it's more the former.
Yeah.
Because I don't see them as being, I don't really think that any life form that, you know, is like manifest physically is like in service of anything.
Yeah.
Negative.
I'm with
humans.
You. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think if anything, it's more like a physical manifestation of like a portal, you know, into some other thing. And, you know, I think that maybe a lot of that is probably like eons long collective conscious construct that we've just kind of like entered into. So it's not like they're like actually some kind of like gateway, but because we've like associated them with that for so long that like the gateway as we understand it is you know, associated with them in one way or the other.
Certainly.
And, you know, sometimes bad shit just happens.
Right.
And also really, like, wonderful things that I've seen still to this day. Like, one of the most inexplicable things that I've seen in nature was one day I was, I used to work at the massage school down on 13th Street.
Right.
And I kind of ran a, like, a community garden there for a while. And one day I was out in the garden, and I saw an owl, like, flying from one tree to another, and it was, like, about this time. It was, like, daylight, but it was, like, today, overcast. And so, you know, I hollered at him, and he, you know, came down a little closer. And I was like, wow, you know, like, there he is, you know. I did it again.
Oh, my God.
And it looked at me for a little bit, and, you know, like, maybe I'm just being rude, you know, or like, less reverent, or just kind of, like, annoying or whatever. So it looks at me for a little bit, and then it flies across the property, and I followed it, and it landed in a big oak tree, and, you know, sat there staring at it. And again, like at best, just really annoying, you know, at worst, like, probably, like, disrespectful.
You're talking about you?
Yeah, me.
Right, okay.
Yeah, definitely. And no, not the owl.
Right. I mean, I assumed, but I just want to make sure. Yeah.
And so then I hear this hawk, you know, come, like, screaming across the prairie, and it alights in a tree probably 20 or 30 feet from the owl. And now we're standing in kind of, like, a triangular, you know.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Manner, you know, like, I'm standing here. Owl's up there, kind of to my right at a 45-degree angle. The hawk's up to my left. And they, without making a sound, just both took off from their respective perches at the same time. They met in the air. They locked talons.
Oh my God.
In a very, like, calm, smooth, graceful way. They didn't struggle or lash out at each other. It was very smooth and graceful. They locked talons. They spun around three times, and then they let go at the same time, and they took off in, like, two separate directions without making any noise. You know, no feathers falling on the ground. They didn't really fall very far to the ground, too. They just, it was almost like they were like, yo, let's do that thing that we do.
Yeah, like, it's like a dance.
Yeah, almost like a dance. You know, so that was great. Shout out to that owl and that hawk, you know.
How did it, like, what were you thinking?
I wasn't thinking anything. I was just like, oh, I'm going to follow the owl. And then I was like, oh, cool, the hawk's here. And then I spent, you know, the rest of the day on the internet trying to find...
Yeah, see if this, like, is like...
any kind of documented... you know, instance of this happening. And the only thing that I could find is that, you know, when, you know, two raptors of the same species are mating, they'll do things like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, they weren't mating, and they weren't.
Yeah, that's not what this was.
No idea what it was.
So what I mean, like, what were you thinking or whatever is, I guess I'm thinking more like, I've had experiences that are inexplicable, but the emotion that I get from it is very clear.
Right? Oh, yeah.
You know, where I don't understand what I just saw, but mm-hmm. I do know that I'm, like, either frightened or I'm in awe or, you know, something like, so what was, do you remember what you felt like seeing this? It's such an odd thing that you're describing.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, just a general sense of disbelief and curiosity.
Yeah.
You know, like I said, I'd never seen anything like it before. I'd never heard about this. You know, I've at different points in my life been fascinated in different, you know, aspects of natural sciences and never, you know, heard of or seen footage of, you know, anything like this. You know, I always have a lot of fun encountering things in nature and then, you know, interpreting the symbolism in my mind as like a little game.
Yeah.
You know, not taking it seriously, but just being like, oh, that would be cool. And that would be cool. But because, you know, like you can't take that stuff too seriously because, you know, if you do, I think you end up becoming a victim of your own creation. And then you kind of like lock yourself into
yes.
some patterns of thinking and all this other kind of thing. And it's usually just ends up being, you know, like illusory at best and kind of disorienting.
Well, and maybe that's like the portal that you're talking about, you know, like I feel as though humans, it's so easy for us to allow ourselves to go down those rabbit holes, especially when it comes with an experience like something like that, where it feels really mm-hmm. important and it feels like you know what it meant, or you know what, you know, there's some implication and there's some symbology behind it or symbolism behind it. And then you indulge it. And I'm not discouraging people from indulging, like you just said, like you do it, you walk, you know, and you're thinking about it and it's like an activity. It's like fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's no stakes because you're just like, wouldn't it be cool if it was this or what mm-hmm. if it was that? Or, and I think that that's a really important realm to be able to swim around in, as long as you know how to get out. You know, as long as right. you know how to, that's something that I've really worked on to try to like, when it comes to stuff like what we're talking about, things that are not an acute science, but instead it's sort of like just theory or just what it feels or what it could be. And I found that I got great relief when I allowed myself to like set a timer almost to say like, you know, like during the pandemic, I allowed myself to dig into like the UFO lore stuff because that's okay. something I've always been interested in my whole life. And I was like, man, I've never allowed myself to do it because of my ego, I guess. I'm afraid people are going to think I'm a weirdo or they're going to think I'm a fool or I don't know what. But this occurred to, when I started digging into them, it was a lot of fun and it was sometimes like freaky and the thoughts that you have after, like, what if this is true? What if this, what if that? Mm-hmm. And I found that what worked best was just to say like, for the hour and a half that I'm watching this documentary or for the hour that it takes me to read this chapter in the book or whatever it is that I'm absorbing, I'm allowing myself to like, just buy into it. And just yeah, sure. do it. And then at the end, I'd be like, all right, now I don't have to anymore. Mm-hmm. And what would start happening is like certain stuff would just gone and never would come back. And then yeah. other things would kind of like come back. Maybe not, you know, I wouldn't go searching in my brain for them, but like maybe it would like pop up in a conversation or mm-hmm. maybe it would just pop into my mind out of nowhere. And I think like, all right. I'm gonna think about that again, I guess, you know, and and we'll see what happens.
I'm gonna think about that again, I guess, is a great summary of, you know, like I don't know, the human experience. Yeah. At least the waking state.
I guess I'm gonna think about that again, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure. And just a great way to describe, you know, any sort of, you know, practice in you know, awareness or
yeah
yeah.
One of the things that like, because I've only really known you for, I don't know, what's it been like, 2 years, a year and a half, two yeah, years,
something like that.
The first time that we ever really talked was about the owls. That's right. But like right off the bat, one of the reasons why you felt like a safe person and somebody that I immediately had respect and awe for was because you have that, you said it just a second ago, you have this like innate curiosity about you. I think that that is a quality that is almost universal for me as being like, oh, okay, this is like someone who I'm safe with. This person's an acquaintance. I want to make the step from acquaintance to friend. And the more I've gotten to know you, the more I've confirmed, like, yes, this guy is a curious person who is, you're full of stuff that I want to know about. I'm not really sure why I'm like pouring this out on you right now, except for the fact that you sat right down and you started making me curious. And the owl stuff is something that is so... that is so on my mind. I can't tell you how often I sort of battle in myself with the exact same thing you're talking about, because there are so many cultures that have this healthy fear of owls and this sort of like, don't look at them.
Yeah.
Don't make eye contact. Don't, when there's an owl, you're not safe. Audrey and I right now are rewatching Twin Peaks.
Oh,
the
yeah.
owls are not what they seem.
No,
and I'm,
yeah.
I'm going through the whole thing and I'm thinking like, are all the owls, like, they kind of make this implication that the owls are bad, but are all of them bad? Like, are they just embodiments of this, like, other world that exists? There's good and bad in this other world as well. And it's odd because our experience with the owls in our yard, we felt like the luckiest people on earth. We would have, during when they were like raising their owlets, the two owls would take turns. The original owls we called Hoot and Annie, and they would take turns watching over the little owlets in the hole, and then the other one would sit in our front yard in our oak tree and keep an eye on them. And it was the coolest thing to watch. And this is how we met Larson and Leanne. They'd be walking down the street and they'd see the owl too, and then we bring them back and say, like, here's the owl hole and here's the little baby owls. And so our experience with the owls is this such a positive, like, thank you for being here, thank you for, you know, watching over the house. And it felt special. And then to find so much lore warning people, like, fucking watch out for those owls. In UFO lore, have you ever heard any of the stuff about owls in UFO lore or alien lore?
Is there any overlap with like the Moloch people and the Bohemian Grove people and all that stuff? Or,
you know,
or
I think there is. I know less about that.
Yeah.
The Bohemian Grove stuff, I know that, you know, there's the giant owl statue.
Right.
And for those listening who don't know, Bohemian Grove is like a...
it's like the, like, rich occult Riviera.
Right, exactly. I couldn't have put
they
it better.
All just yet. Go, and, you know, who knows, you know, what it is exactly. But I think probably all these people just, you know, want... you know, all of us lay folks to think that they're doing like way cooler stuff than maybe they actually are.
Yeah, I mean, that I certainly think that there's, I think it's natural for traditions to lose potency as the generations go on. And so, like, I could believe that, I find myself leaning toward like the people who maybe started Bohemian Grove were maybe a little bit more, I don't know, connected to something, or at least like maybe they knew more what they were doing or something. And now it's more like, well, my grandpa did this and now I'm going to do it. And, or maybe I have no idea what I'm talking about. You know, maybe it's all bullshit or it's all real.
Yeah.
I know that there's a giant owl statue. I know that there's like some weird sex stuff that happens apparently, and and I know that one of the traditions is that they all urinate on a tree for like one of their
you know, good for them.
Yeah
sounds like fun.
Sounds like a really good time for the rich people.
I'd be lying if I said I didn't get together with people and all pee on trees.
Yeah, being on trees is a great tradition.
Did it today.
Is there any, I mean, this is a side note because I want to get back to the owl thing, but but you, one of your areas of expertise is trees and flora and fauna in general, especially, would you say that your expertise is limited to like the Southeast, or is it something that you know, you're like expanding out?
Southeast is definitely my wheelhouse.
Yeah.
And it becomes less my wheelhouse as we get farther out of the Southeast. But I know a couple things.
Yeah, I know you do.
What's your question?
Well, this is just in general. Like, is there any harm? I think about this sometimes. Is there harm done to a tree by somebody peeing on it, urinating on it? Like,
it depends on the tree and the location and how much pee we're talking about.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. It just depends. Everything that you hear about that's good or bad for plants and animals, it's all just depends.
So like that cherry tree that I've got in the backyard, that's a spot where I sometimes pee.
Great.
And I think it's great for it.
Sure. Yeah.
It likes the acidic.
It would be. It's very unlikely that that cherry tree is even absorbing your urine.
Yeah.
Because trees and all plants, really, they absorb, you know, nutrients and water. A lot of it actually comes from the mycelial connection in the, like, microscopically small end of the rootlets that they make, which is the most distal part of the plant. To whatever degree that the rootlets themselves are absorbing anything or taking anything into them through, like, I mean, it's like, so it's on such a small scale that it's literally like an ion exchange at like the atomic level almost. And, so when trees are doing that, a decent rule of thumb is that, given enough space, a tree's roots are at least 3 times the diameter of the canopy.
Okay.
So cherry tree in the backyard is what, like 20, maybe 30 feet wide at best.
Yeah.
So if the cherry tree is absorbing anything, it's absorbing stuff from like your neighbor's yard.
That's so cool.
Yeah. I know, it is really cool.
So fucking cool.
It's great. Yeah. Yeah. And everything, as you get closer, the roots, their function is more stability,
yeah,
and structure, you know. And there's all kinds of really excellent side effects from that too, like it stabilizes the soil, it gives water a place to go, you know, it creates all kinds of micro environments that innumerable beings that we probably don't know the names of and we'll never ever see, you know, live out their whole lives in and around.
Yeah man, one of the biggest deficits I have in my education is the result of focusing so much on social, like human societal elements, which I think we are fascinating. I think humans have the capacity to be really wonderful, incredible beings. And so that's why I'm obsessed with it. You know, that's why I'm so into it. But the world that surrounds us, that was here before us, and that exists sort of like with or without us, is so complex and so enormously advanced. And it just, every time I have a moment where I'm like, I can't believe I've been focusing on all this other shit. Like, you know, social emotional stuff is, I mean, it's a spiraling rabbit hole as well. And you can go deep and it's complicated and it's unique and it's wonderful. I just wish there was enough time and room for me to like get it all.
Yeah.
Instead.
Yeah. Well, you know, the shoes on the other foot, you know, a lot of folks who, you know, study the natural sciences and things of that nature,
yeah,
you know, a lot of times are really, wish that there was more time for them to study, you know, arts and humanities and social sciences and things like that, or, you know, sciences as they pertain to, the human mind or the human body, or, you know, chemistry, or like any of these other things. And, you know, all that stuff is part of natural science. I mean,
we can't escape it.
Yeah. Go kind of touching a little bit back on the UFO thing. Like I'm really not sold on the whole idea that like humans or aliens. I think the evidence is there that, like, we are totally, like, of this, of the, like, continuous chain of life on this planet.
Yeah.
You know, maybe the, like, maybe the ingredients, mm-hmm. which, you know, eventually gave rise to life on this planet, came from outer space or whatever, but then, you know, outer, you know, like, the stuff in outer space didn't just, like, come out of nowhere either. Like, there's literally right. no end to the thread.
It's all, yeah, it's all from it. I mean,
right.
Yeah.
And so that includes everything that, you know, people see as separate from nature, like cars and buildings right. and gasoline and, like, all that stuff, like, didn't come from aliens. Like, it's from the Earth.
Right.
And, you know,
it's all part of the progression.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, if a bunch of, like, gas in a vacuum can become a star that can, like, explode and, like, shoot, like, gold everywhere, right. then, like, it totally follows that, like, some, like, weird little two-legged animals on a planet with a, you know, with an air bubble around it can, you know, make concrete
sure yeah.
you know, and, like,
yeah.
yank, you know, a natural gas out of infinitely thin fissures in the, like, 1%, you know, deep, you know, layer around the planet, you know, the crust of our planet,
right?
And that's just all we've come to see so far, and who knows, like, what the actual nature of all of that, you know, it really is.
I couldn't agree more. I think it's, like, I don't know if I want to call it my favorite because it annoys me, but it's one of the most glaring blunders that I hear mostly intelligent people utter mm-hmm. is these they'll say something that indicates that they believe that there is some separation between us and nature or us and, you know, and you hear it from people on all sides of political spectrums and everything like that. This, mm-hmm. this idea that humans somehow are emergent and, like, breaking away
sure.
from nature or something like that. And, yeah, you're 100% correct. Every single thing that we make is just a product of nature, right? Mm. We are, as unnatural as it may be. I mean, styrofoam is a yeah. product of nature. Even it's That's like right. it's an abomination, but it's we made it.
Well, you know, it came from somewhere and it's going to go somewhere. And
yeah.
you know how it all ends up. I mean, who knows? I mean, I think it's literally ignorant, not like stupid, not like insulting, like
yeah.
literally like ignoring reality. Like
yes.
it's ignorant to think that. You know, that the styrofoam is going to, like, stay in the state that it's in and that it's totally antithetical to life on this planet. I mean, it, you know, does it cause harm? Sure.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the tricky thing about classifying things is, like,
yeah.
helping and harming and good and bad and creating these dualities that we try to shape nature into is, like, once you start going down that rabbit hole, you start boxing yourself in, and then it really starts fucking you up whenever you try to, you know, box out all the bad stuff and box in all the good stuff, and then you're in your little good box, and then there's something bad in there, or it turns out that being in the good box is actually bad.
Yes, exactly.
It's not so fun anymore, and then things start to change.
Well, and that's one of the things, again, it's another thing that sticks out for me, that there are these large assumptions made that deserve a revisit, like, logically. And one of them, you just made me think of one of the main ones, is, like, this human perspective of drawing these lines about... Mm-hmm. So, for example, one of the arguments that comes up more regularly for me, and I swear I'm not trying to, like, stir the pot or try to, like... I'm all for conservation. I'm all for, like, what's good for nature and everything like that. But when we talk about things like invasive species, right? And, like, and like native plants in comparison to invasive plants, I always want to, like... First of all, I'm encouraging native plants as much as I can in our garden, in Florida in general. Like, I want... You know, I want flora to thrive. And yet I can't help but think, like, who's drawing the line of, like, when something is native or invasive? Like, everything's invasive, right? Or nothing is invasive, right? It's like things think now, like, humans introduce things that maybe wouldn't be introduced so soon, right? But there are plants, like, where do we have the cutoff? Like, something is native if it's been here 100 years, 500 years, 1,000 years, 1,000,000 years, right? Like, who is there somebody making that distinction? There is somebody?
Yeah.
Okay. And it's, is there a line? Is there a number?
So, just like anything else,
yeah,
you'll get different answers. I'll give you my answer.
I'm so glad I'm talking to you
as
about
a professional natural
yes,
scientist.
Yes.
I'll give you my arbitrary and arbitrary opinion that is obviously a result of not just, you know, my own research, but also just everything that's happened in my life and how I filter it in my brain and how I think about things.
Right.
I get what you're saying. It's a balance, and yeah, how you decide what the balance is obviously, like, up to you. It's up to, you know, how you filter the world according to everything that has ever happened to you and what you aspire to do. So my take on invasive species, for example, there are invasive plants and animals in a lot of ecosystems on this planet. Pretty much all of them.
Yeah.
In some form. you asked who makes that decision. In Florida, it's the Florida Invasive Species Council.
Right.
You know, like, there literally are people who make this call. I don't know what goes into their thought.
Well, yeah, I knew that there's somebody who decides.
Yeah, they're deciding it. They're deciding it. And usually, you know, they're right. Like, there are examples where a lot of these plants are causing environmental degradation. Now, where I start to be kind of contrarian, but also, like, where's the lie, is that humans, especially humans who are part of a society who is upholding a legacy of colonialism and genocide,
yep,
have a lot of gall, yep, calling some fucking grass invasive.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, like, yes, like we were saying earlier, yes, roads can be argued to be, like, a natural phenomenon, like, all animals create pathways,
yep,
from point A to point B. When humans make roads, the number of animals that are, like, killed for no reason and not, you know,
right,
used in any other kind of way, who are just trying to live their lives, goes up. You know, it's like in the U.S., it's like 400 million animals a year,
yeah,
roadkill kind of thing. And
and
it's sad. That's a lot.
I struggle with that a lot. Audrey struggles with it too. We talk about it all
the time.
It's
a lot. You know, I try to pull them out of the road. I at least try to not run them over again, because a lot of times, especially with possums, whose evolved defense mechanism is to play dead.
Oh yeah.
A lot of times they are playing dead.
Wow.
And if, you know, 'cause I've stopped and, like, been like, oh, I'm gonna move his body, you know, and he's like, wakes up and is like, like, oh shit, sorry, let me help
you
out.
Get the fuck out of the road, yeah, man.
let me help you. I'm sorry, I have, yeah, to drag you by your tail.
Yeah,
please don't bite me.
Seriously.
But if you do, I understand. No hard feelings. So going back to invasives, though, the way I see it is, like, and again, like, we're getting, like, granular into, like, human created, you know, lines. Sure, like, everybody feel free to, like, critique me, but hear me out.
I'm all ears.
A species of plant or animal is something that is, like genetically and like physically and chemically, and then also, like, culturally, like, plants and animals, like, have culture and things that they share with you know, each other and pass along and all that kind of thing. Like, you know, acknowledge that, or at least feel free to assume that that's happening, even if you can't prove it to yourself. A species evolves in a landscape. So it's native to the landscape.
Yeah.
And can other species come into that landscape and adapt, or what's called like naturalize to it?
Yes.
Without impeding the, let's call them, traditional life cycles and habits of the native species. Yes, they absolutely can. But can species come into the landscape and cause disruptions to those life cycles? Yes.
Yeah.
And so when, you know, I deal with mostly with plants, but so like, let's talk about plants. If a plant comes in and starts disrupting the life cycle of so many things that the ecology, so like that entire web of all the innumerable life cycles and traditions and behaviors and all those things starts to break down,
yeah,
to where there's no, like, there's no going around the obstacle anymore. Like, there's literally no path, and now you're literally facing, you know, extinction.
Yeah, collapse.
Yeah. So when that starts to happen, then yes, it's invasive, because things can get to a point where extinction is the only thing that's happening. Now, is extinction inevitable? Arguably, yes.
Right.
And like, are we pro extinction? It's like, right. Is that what we're trying to do here? Like, for me, no, because facilitating extinction is directly in contrast to, you know, my motivations in life and how I want to show up.
Sure.
You know, is anyone perfect? No. Do you have to yank up every coral ardesia that you see? No.
Like, but it would be good.
Yeah. Or at least, you know, I got a lot of love for the people who, you know, do like invasive removals in, you know, in our part of the world.
Yes.
Because it does play a role in restoring ecology, which has a directly positive benefit, not just for humans, but for like all the other non-human people that have been living here for millennia.
Sure.
And when you remove invasives, you're not pushing the invasive species to the brink of extinction.
Right. They've got other places.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, and are they threatened in other places? Yes. And do people who classify things as invasive consider that? Most of them actually do.
Yeah. Okay.
There's, I can't think of any examples right now, but there's lots of examples of where something will begin to be threatened and go extinct in its native habitat, and it will naturalize or even become invasive in other places. And people take that into consideration whenever they are managing,
yeah,
you know, those landscapes.
That makes sense.
It's hard, and it does start to seem like kind of like either a lost cause or incredibly idealistic, because a lot of land management for people other than humans is like not really how a lot of the world is like set up to be. And there's a systematic issue at play where, you know, sometimes there's all these other human cause pressures that stress ecology so much that you're just like, we'll take what we can get.
Sure.
You know, like a great example is the camphor trees. Camphor trees are considered to be invasive, at least in Florida. In other places, I'm not so sure, but in Florida, they are considered to be invasive, but they're not like, it's not as bad as it could be. So they aren't fully disrupting ecology everywhere they are. It happens in some places, but not everywhere. And especially in urban settings where, like, again, like
we've done way more damage.
Yeah, right. Like we can be like, oh well, let's get rid of the invasive species, but then you've got like 6-lane highways and you know, commercial redevelopment that is modeled around construction and demolition rather than like rehabilitation and right. recycling. You know, like all that considered, you know what? Let's keep the camphor tree. But the what's happening aside from the humans is that because of global trade, this incredibly tiny insect that's part of an entire family of incredibly tiny insects, beetles, they're called ambrosia beetles. They're really fascinating. A female beetle will collect fungal spores and kind of like stick them in her armpit, and she'll go find a tree that is a species that's a host tree. So it's a particular species that these beetles have evolved over millions of years to complete their life cycle in. This one particular ambrosia beetle completes its life cycle in trees that are in the laurel family. In Florida, native laurels are red bay, swamp bay, sassafras, and then, you know, I'll go ahead and call avocados native because they've been cultivated in the Caribbean for long enough you know, it's like, it's native, it grows here. So all these are Laurasiae, laurel family. On the other side of the ocean, probably the most famous laurel is going to be bay leaves.
Right. Okay.
Incidentally, my name is a derivation of the word laurel.
Oh, really? Yeah. Larson. Yeah.
Yeah. So the ambrosia beetle takes her little fungal spores and she makes a tiny little hole in the red bay tree, and she digs a little garden and she plants her fungal spores and she lays her eggs, and then she leaves, and then the eggs hatch. And when the eggs hatch, the fungal spores have started to like grow and produce little like mycelium. And so, when they hatch, they eat the little mycelium and they're like doing really well. But when this happens, it actually kills the cambium, the living tissue of the red bay tree, and the tree dies.
Wow.
And
Does it die because many of these beetles have done this, or does it die because one beetle has done this?
Many of them.
Okay.
But there's a lot of them.
A lot. Okay, yeah.
There's so many of them. And it's and this has happened to such a degree that in the Southeast, Red Bay especially is being pushed to like the brink of extinction.
Wow.
Like there was a guy at the University of Florida who was doing research into trying to figure out like how to basically genetically engineer resistant red bays, and he left UF because he, you know, couldn't take it anymore. Part of the brain drain of UF that's ongoing right now.
Really? Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know where they're at with all that, but as far as I know, it's like a big deal because the red bays, you know, it's not just a pretty tree that has good smelling leaves that grows in our environment. Where it relates to camphor trees are also a laurel. This is why this is important. The red bays make these tasty little berries, and all kinds of people like to eat the berries, all kinds of birds, all kinds of deer. And with the red bay tree going extinct, that source of food is going along with it.
Oh, I see. So yeah.
The berries that the camphor tree makes are filling in the niche.
Interesting.
The empty niche. So a lot of times when something is invasive, it is because there's nothing else in nature that is like keeping it in check.
Right.
You know, that's why years ago, I don't know if you remember, when UF found the air potato beetles that are from like Japan, and they released like a ton of them in Gainesville to see what would happen. And, you know, like when I first moved to Gainesville, like so much stuff was just covered in air potatoes. And when they released those beetles, like it started kind of going away slowly but surely. These little red beetles started showing up everywhere. So, you know, that's like one way to like kind of naturally manage like invasive species. So you got to have something that's going to keep them in check. So people are keeping the camphor berries in check. When I was working down in Polk County, I saw a lot of like bobcat scat, and it was just full of camphor berries. And I was like, oh, cool. Good for them. I had no idea bobcats are eating camphor berries.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah. So it's not always a loss, but it is kind of like rolling the dice, because it's just like every other kind of like environmental catastrophe that you can tie back to human activity. Is like, is it something that's inevitable? Like maybe, but the fact that we're speeding it up is kind of the problem.
Yes.
Like, will the climate change on Earth on its own? Yes.
Yeah.
You know, but like,
are we
not
pushing fast forward?
Yeah. Like not this quick, except in cases where like volcanoes erupt or meteors hit the Earth.
Right.
You know, like it's not usually supposed to go this quick. Like the reason why things can even become species, you know, and become native to a landscape is because it like takes a long time, and it's the result of like a lot of different symbiotic things happening.
That totally makes sense. And you're kind of touching on, you reminded me of sort of like the mindset that I took when, so my resistance about like the native thing or the invasive thing, my resistance was sparked by some people would call it like foolish or whatever, but I find it odd that we give less, we seem to have less sympathy for life that we don't individualize, right? Like trees, we call it like, that's an oak tree. It's not, that's Jeff, right?
Yeah.
It's like, that's an oak tree, just like every other oak tree. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like here's a Cuban tree frog. That's not, you know, Lemmy, the Cuban tree frog. It's a Cuban tree frog, right?
Leanne actually does have a Cuban tree frog that lives in one of our planting installations, and his name is Rupert. Shout out to Rupert. We, you know, a lot of people are big proponents of catch the Cuban tree frogs and throw them in the freezer.
Yes.
Yeah, we don't do that.
Right.
Well, we, you know, we're like, cool, Rupert, good to see you.
See, and you're nailing it. This was the catalyst for this for me, was Audrey's dad, Dennis, is a trooper for catching the tree frogs and putting them in the freezer. And I get it. You know, he explained, you know, it's not like he just started doing it. He did his research. He, you know, he's got his reasons. And my thing with it was, I'd see this tree frog and I think like, this, it's not like this guy was part of an invasion, you know, like this particular tree frog wasn't like, come on, let's go get him. He's just here and he's trying to survive.
That's right.
And he's eating what he's got to eat, you know, and that's what I am.
That's right.
I'm an invader, and I'm just eating what I can eat to survive, trying to get through, trying to do as little damage as I can, you know, but following my instincts for the most part. And so it started this line of thinking of like, well, then, you know, when do we, like this plant right here is just trying to survive, right? And it's doing what it does to survive, and it's negatively affecting these other things. And so what I started thinking about was like, okay, like, just like if, you know, let's just say, hypothetically speaking, that there's a country out there that's being invaded by another country, right? And this country that's being invaded is our ally, right? And because we're allies, we've agreed to help protect this country, right? And so we do what we can to protect it. And that's kind of what I feel, that's how I can get on board with you know, being an enthusiast for native species in our area and making sure that, you know, I've allied myself, I've made an alliance with the flora and the fauna of this land here. And yeah, like you're saying, like if something comes in and is threatening the life of this thing and threatening the equilibrium that's been created, then I'm okay with saying like, hey, I've made an agreement to protect this land and, you know, whatever. And so I'm gonna try to stop it. But it is hard for me. I think it's harder for me to do it with animals. And that's just a bias that I have because mm-hmm. I'm an animal. And so I assign more value to them.
Right.
But I do find it hard, like with the Cuban tree frogs. I once played a trick on Dennis where he'd been trying to catch this frog and he finally got it, and he got it in a Ziploc bag, and he went and he took it to the freezer, and then he like went and did something else, and I snuck into the room where they with the freezer in it, and I took the bag out and I let the frog free. And then I went back and I left the Ziploc bag in the freezer, but I left it open. And I thought, like, Dennis is going to go back and think, like, the frog, like, broke out of the freezer or something. And I was waiting for, like, a week waiting for Dennis to be like, you know, that fucking tree frog, it just, I don't know where it is. Is that it? He never looked once. Like, he totally forgot. He never even noticed that I did it. But I kind of felt good, like freeing this guy. Like, you didn't do anything wrong, man. You're just,
No.
You're just trying to survive.
Just like the, you know, if you know, going back to your analogy of countries invading countries across imagined borders and barriers.
Yes, being
compelled by people who are probably not part of the invasion.
Right.
You know, they don't really have any skin in the game.
Exactly.
You know, from a bird's eye view, you can kind of make a like a moral decision about who you're going to help and go defend and what you're going to defend them against. But then when you get down to the granular level and you discover that like one of the soldiers who is invading your friend's, you know, land is this guy named Rupert.
That's right.
And he's, you know,
he's following orders.
And you know, doing what he's got to do, and he's got a family and he's got motivations, and you know, even if it's something that you can't understand, there's intrinsic value in it. I mean, I believe that.
Yeah.
And you know, he's going to die anyway.
Yeah.
Some way or another. Then it's like, well, I see a lot of myself in you. Probably not going to kill you, Rupert.
Right.
And I think that that's an important thing to recognize and understand too, is that the way that we understand invasive species is the same construct that gave rise to the society that is living out a legacy of colonialism and genocide in our modern world. Even though the term invasive species is like a militaristic kind of call to arms, and like nativist, you know, imaginary line in the sand that, you know, is really popular because what's popular in our society is like militarism and nationalism.
Exactly right.
And so it's easy, you know, to call all sorts of things invasive, humans and non-humans.
Yes.
For the people who are into that.
Right.
Because it's literally how they see the world. And they prefer that to having a relationship with the land that usually isn't going to give quote unquote invasive species the chance to even become an issue.
Right.
If you know, like here's a big if, like in if, or I don't want to talk about this. So I used to work on this crew.
Thank you for listening to part one of my conversation with Larson McBride. Larson is truly a breath of fresh air. As we mentioned, he lives down the street. He walks up and down the street every day. Every time I catch him, it's a gift. I feel very lucky to call him a friend and neighbor. I love his mind. He's so independently minded. He does so much reflection. He doesn't allow social norms to be his guiding post. He and his partner, Leanne Averill, who, by the way, is the owner and the mastermind behind A Thousand Leaves Herb Shop downtown. You got to get down to A Thousand Leaves. Leanne is a master of concoction and can help you with ailments, can help you just keep yourself healthy, you know, preventative care. She makes wonderful tea combinations. She is a one of a kind person. So shout out to A Thousand Leaves Herb Shop and Leanne Averill, who is also one of my D&D partners. Right now, her character's name is Belladonna, and she is a badass. And Larson sometimes joins us as well. Larson has played many characters, my favorite name being Granny Weebix. None of this means anything to half of you. So anyways, just shout out to Granny Weebix. Larson and Leanne have a beautiful relationship. They're both so considerate and trusting to each other. They exemplify a relationship that both celebrates connection and individuality, which is something that, again, is not a social norm. They both do a great job being independent, and then the cherry on top is when they get to be together. And that is a beautiful thing to watch from over here. So I continue my conversation with Larson. We really get into it, and it keeps on getting better and better. So please don't waste any more time. Hop on over to episode 2 and continue your journey with the one and only Larson McBride. Thank you so much for finding your way here today, and be well.